I have to say that yesterday when I listened to all the talks, I felt slightly alienated, simply because I'm an historian of Africa. I'm not an economic historian, and I work on the 20th century. And I have to say that the debate about the Great Divergence has had not many effects on African economic history. Of course, Gareth Austin was one of the few historians of Africa who felt inspired by this debate. William as well, but William works on all kinds of topics and all over the world, so I wouldn't consider him as an historian of Africa only. But otherwise, this debate did not really attract too many people. On the other hand, there has been at the same time a certain rise again of economic history of Africa, but I think not very closely connected to the Great Divergence debate, and also fueled very much by economists hijacking African history and writing or producing a lot of peer-reviewed nonsense. My context I'm talking here is more on global labor history. That's another historiographical branch that started to grow around 2000. And what I'm looking here, despite my title, which I had to give far too early, and later I thought about what I could say. So I will talk mainly about the relationship of capital and labor at the example of Africa, 20th century Africa. And two elements of the relationship of capitalism and labor stand out, I think, that are on the grounds relations between power and ideology. And the starting point for analyzing both is the writing of The Concept of the Gentleman, Karl Marx, who I think is still an important figure when we talk about capitalism, and we share the same hairdresser, by the way. And what I want to talk about here especially is Marx's concept of primitive, or as one has to say now, original accumulation, because the German word ursprünglich means original, and primitive is a kind of slightly disorienting translation. And in the 25 first chapters of Capital, Marx portrayed a powerful systemic logic built on the assumption that labor was fully commoditized. And then in chapter 26, he argued that these assumptions had, notably in the case of Great Britain, been met by the forceful removal of most cultivators from land and the legal and administrative structure that enforced this political, social and coercive process. And he led to an expropriation that was written, as he put it so nicely, in letters of blood and fire. How this came to be could not be explained on the basis of capital logic. Primitive accumulation was thus a contingent process located at the intersection of different historical trends, including the relationships of crown and aristocracy in Britain, the changing legal framework in which landlords and different categories of tenants operated, the extensions of British commerce overseas, including the slave trade and plantation agriculture in the West Indies, and inter-imperial rivalries that shaped the capacity of the state and financial institutions to reinforce each other's influence. And all these points have been the subject of considerable scholarly investigation and questioning ever since, and some people here in the room have been part of that debate. The other side of the story of the primitive or original accumulation was the way it was written out of elite ideology, despite much effort on the part of its victims. What Marx termed the fetishism of commodities treated the human story of how labor became an object as if it was a natural condition, a relationship of things rather than a relationship of people. As much recent scholarship has shown, employer-workers' relationships, even in the British case, were nested in layers of state regulation, juridical enforcement, and outright coercion. But if free and coerced labor were anything but dichotomous, the representation of labor in a realm defined by the legal control of property, or lack thereof, and the neutrality of the market relationship was crucial to the development of an ideological basis for capitalist development. The anti-slavery movement, as Thomas Sehode and others have shown, however diverse the motivations of its leading actors were, had the effect of defining a realm of an ethically defensible form of labor distinguished from others. In such a political structure, The working class movements could still make claims, as they did, but the domain of claim making was defined by the acceptance of the wage relationship itself. I think, and a number of people start to think it again, that the concept of original accumulation is extremely useful beyond the paradigmatic English case, which of course has its own complexities, and I don't dare to dwell into that, of course. Not because it can be applied as a template, but exactly because it cannot. One can focus on specific processes in Africa by which people acquired productive resources and excluded others from them. Land, productive trees, nodal points on trade routes, for example. The concept encourages us to ask exactly what resources were commanded by whom, on what basis, and who was excluded from them, on what basis and with what effects. These are by all means empirical questions and will give rise to diverse answers. And of course, there are a couple of cases when you talk about capitalism in Africa, and the first case is always South Africa. Because in South Africa, the alienation of land went further than any place else. Complicated by the racialized nature of the process and the fiction that Africans maintained the integrity of pre-capitalist societies. The mineral discoveries in the second half of the 19th century and subsequent expansion of the industrial sector of the economy led to the emergence of an industrial workforce that included thousands of European immigrants and a large number of Africans, and for a shorter period also Chinese workers and Indian workers. The workforce in the South African mines was divided along racial lines, whereby Europeans were assigned to supervisory positions while Africans were relegated to unskilled and menial tasks. A crucial legal step was a Land Act of 1913 that consolidated a policy of depriving the vast majority of black South Africans of land ownership. This act was crucial in driving down black real wages. We talked about real wages yesterday for two reasons. It not only reserved 93% of the land for whites, but also prohibited African tenancy on white-owned land. Before that time, sharecrop tenancy had probably been the most important way in which black farmers could still sell produce to the market rather than selling their labor power. The key to the capitalist character of South African development can be located in agriculture. Since the 17th century, a culturally and socially distinct land-owning class has been emerging, one that tightening its grip on land in the context of industrialization, forcing tenants to become wage laborers and bringing about a landless African proletariat in the process. Elsewhere, there were specific regions where such alienation took place, but there were many more regions where differential access to land and other resources took forms more complicated than a dichotomy of land alienation and communal land tenure. The classic case, a case Gareth Austin knows so well, is West African cocoa producers, where the people with a prior claim to land, migrants who planted the cocoa bushes, and kinsmen, clients, labor tenants, and other workers who did the labor, mark a system of relations that brought about innovation and relative prosperity without corresponding to the elite norms of freehold property basic to both Marxist and neoclassical economies. In still other instances, Africans were able to straddle with varying degrees of autonomy and security and over the individual life cycle and or the family unit between wage labor and agriculture in the context of family and community. In recent decades, governing elites and foreign investors have been buying up land, not necessarily using its productivity, but leaving many people without either the security that access to land through kinship and community had once provided, or any realistic possibility of supporting themselves through wage labor. I mean, the phenomenon of land grabbing, as it is called, is widely discussed for a number of years. In the 1970s and 80s, when African labor history was at its height, scholars were keen on words like proletarianization or, to show that they're good Thomsonians, the making of an African working class. The stories were linear, of capitalism spreading steadily over the globe. This story didn't just get the future wrong. That's something historians do often as economists. But it got the past wrong as well. The growth of a wage labor force was a conjunctural, not an evolutionary phenomenon. And state policy, at least in the French and British African colonies, in the years following World War II, was not geared towards proletarianization, but, as it was called at that time, towards stabilization. Oops. It recognized that wage labor and strikes had become issues in cities, railway lines, mines and ports, and that the best way of making those workers productive was to stop treating them as tribesmen temporarily at work, but as a budding working class that could and should be separated from the vast majority of Africans who lived in the countryside and whose relationship to the means of production could only slowly be transformed and only within their own social milieu. By defining and separating out a working class from the rural masses, that class could be, that was at least the fantasy, that class could be reproduced under the watchful eyes of doctors, nurses, teachers, social workers, and labor officers. Stabilization implied a particular state-directed program to reconfigure the life cycle and intergenerational relations. The post-war doctrine of stabilization looked to some Africans becoming acultural modern men, but kept in place older stereotypes of the rural or rather tribal African. The dichotomous view papered over the historical record that colonial regimes had lacked the power to bring about systematic transformation, that is to bring about a version of primitive original accumulation. Africans could engage in wage labor without giving the totality of their time to their beings to it. They could find niches in colonial economies for themselves that allowed them to stave off capitalist discipline. Space could be placed against time. Mobility was a defense against the rhythms of that Marx described in this chapter on the working day. The consequences of such forms of struggle were beyond what either side could anticipate. From one point of view, Africa was an underexploited continent in the literal sense that the quantity of surplus value that could be extracted was limited by the ability of so many Africans until recent decades to avoid complete subordination to the one that mattered in capitalism in the classic sense. That meant a wide variety of social relations of production coexisted in time and over space. And it makes sense to analyze them not in relation to the individual worker at any point in time, but to the worker over the life course, and each life course in relation to kinship groups, networks, patron-client relations, and so on. And one can go to argue that this complexity, this overlapping of social forms over the life course and over different kinds of social connections, was both a protection and, over time, a constraint. As Mike Dennings argued a few years ago, the worst faced in capitalist society, perhaps, is to be underexploited. What I'm suggesting here is that by turning the model of capitalist development into a set of questions, one can develop a set of perspectives that take us away from singular stories of the ever-extending reach of proletarianization. The stories are about time, life cycle and growth spurts, more than linear time, and they are about space, but so to speak, lumpy space, uneven space, not the infinitely connected space that the word globalization implies. So if we look at the trajectory of Africa, of labor in Africa in the 20th century, we see that colonial regimes, for all their advantages in technology and communication, face limits on their capacity to harness African labor power. Islands of labor exploitation in mines, port cities, and settler farms were surrounded by vast labor catchment areas, which supplied labor power without producing a working class. But the category game was still being played. Missionaries and humanitarian groups campaigned to define and excise forced labor from the repertoire of colonial power, even if they usually defined forced labor rather narrowly, as the use of official coercion for private profit or the abuses of government recruitment, and did not penetrate the patterns of land seizure and power that actually shaped the condition of labor. The tendency to treat free labor as a fetish in colonial circles or among free market purists today should not lead us to invert these conceptions and treat the labor questions in Africa as if a single category of racialized subordination. The efforts of Africans as individuals and as communities, to defend themselves against subordination need to be taken seriously, as does, in some places, the ability of some Africans to create a modest prosperity for themselves. Africans were often trying in their own ways to put family life together. Women might provide much of the labor that kept a wage labor force alive, play a bigger role in agricultural labor than regimes intended, and participate in migratory initiatives to get away from forced labor and to try to establish a more family-oriented pattern of work and social life. It was in this context that the category game, as played by France and Britain, produced a stabilization concept. This would further fragment African society was considered a positive step towards modernizing Africa. Family allowances and other welfare programs did not necessarily produce the kind of Bowden working class officials wished to see. The male breadwinner might use his wages to support his wife's engagement in petty trade or perhaps his own move out of wage labor. He himself might be more intent to become a big man in the sense practiced by his ancestors and relatives rather than the acultural worker and urbanite of the colonial imagination. The relationship of the categories of gender and labor were much more complicated in practice than in the visions of colonial reformers. The line between those included in this colonial vision and those excluded was never very clear. So in any case, stabilization was not proletarianization. Post-World War II, Africa, in this specific and somehow bounded way, was part of the 20th century trend towards providing a measure of security to working classes. As Marcel van der Linden and others have pointed out, this was not a linear trend, but a conjuncture within the longer-term pattern of capitalist development, which depends on the precariousness of the workers' position to enforce labor discipline. The protections afforded to workers in Europe and, to a significantly lesser extent, the United States, are, according to this interpretation, a product of special circumstances of the 20th century, not least the power and potential threat of labor movements, fear of socialist alternatives, the rise of mass consumption, and attempts by elites, especially in democratic societies, to build cross-class conditions and foster something like the French are fond of calling solidarity. This model is now, as we all know, under threat. More and more labor contracts are short-term and benefits are called into question in the name of austerity and flexible labor markets. An African's moment of this welfare moment, or the Trente Glorieuse, as the French call it, was particularly brief. And Jim Ferguson has eloquently described in the case of Zambia what it meant for the gains which the stabilized workers of the 1950s and 60s had made in the Copper Belt had made to be eroded by hostile government policies, the undermining of trade unions, inflation, and the decline of commodity prices. Ferguson has since gone on to argue that precarity is no longer needed to drive people into the labor market. Rather, precarity reflects the decreased need for labor in the world market, perhaps more acute in Africa than in any other places. Rather than unemployment being a temporary condition within the life course, producing certain disciplining effects but also requiring certain kinds of social interventions, it is becoming a permanent condition. South Africa, for example, has to come to grips with the importance of the non-working class, which has been excluded from much of the gains of post-apartheid South Africa. Indeed, the low-paid worker and the migrant worker are likely to be regarded as less than true citizens. For citizenship, and indeed human worth, is, in the minds of South Africans' governing elites, linked to productive work that is available only to a fraction of the population. Some argue that the South African state should get away from the equation of both livelihood and dignity with work and think of mechanisms like basic income grants that allow people to get by, independent of whether they work. But even such an argument presumes that the only work that needs to be done is that for which capital is willing to pay. Moreover, the premise that capital in Africa no longer needs so many workers is questioned by some authors who argue that multinational capital is finding new uses of workers as long as they are cheap, particularly to reach customers of modest means. So this was a kind of rather tour de force through 20th century African labor history. And what I try to emphasize is, in fact, that the relationship of capitalism and labor is neither homogenizing nor linear. So if capitalist development makes it possible to imagine labor as a universal construct across space, in reality, capitalism has homogenized neither space nor time, but has produced great unevenness. This lumpiness is not necessarily optimizing for capitalist accumulation, nor does it produce a congruity between economic practices and ideological representations of them. Thank you very much.